The Oracle Network. Well, hey there, friends, and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today's episode is going to cover part one of one of the most infamous unsolved serial killer cases, the Zodiac Killer. Now, for this first episode, I'm going to take you through the timeline of the Zodiac's confirmed and suspected victims, as well as get into the infamous cryptic letters and the initial facts that police were able to gather about the killer. Next week's episode is going to cover the case's main suspects, as well as where the overall investigation stands today and the most recent updates. The Zodiac Killer petrified the San Francisco Bay Area during his known murder spree from December 1968 to September 1969, sending threatening letters to police and local news media, killing at least six people throughout several counties, but claiming as many as 37 victims over a five-year period. No matter what police did to try to zero in on the killer, the Zodiac always seemed to just slip away, crossing multiple police jurisdictions, thousands of potential suspects, not knowing when or how the killer would strike next, triggered an overwhelming investigation that eventually went cold when the Zodiac sent his final letter in 1978, afterwards ceasing all further contact with the media and police alike. And over 50 years later, the one question still on everyone's mind is, who was the Zodiac? Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. In the 1960s, San Francisco was bustling. Peace, free love, drug experimentation, the hippie movement, all of it was filtering into every corner. In fact, the Bay Area was becoming known as the center of multiple movements. Political protests, anti-war demonstrations, civil rights, and Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 speech, theater troupes, the birth of the Black Panther Party, a nonstop music scene. The San Francisco Giants made it to the World Series in 1962. Wilt Chamberlain was dominating the NBA as part of the Warriors. 1964 gave birth to the free speech movement and a three-month-long protest. And although there are conflicting stories as to who did it first, the burrito became extremely popular here during this time. Yes, the wonderful meat, veggie, cheese, bean, tortilla concoction right here in San Francisco in two competing restaurants. Before the 1967 Summer of Love in the Haight-Ashbury area, Timothy Leary and others led the Human Bean, coining the motto, quote, turn on, tune in, and drop out, end quote. The BART construction began in a plan to give the city and its surrounding areas more accessibility, and if you're a movie buff like me, then you probably, hopefully, maybe, are familiar with one of the best car chase scenes in a film ever that was filmed right there in 1968 in a beautiful green 1968 Ford Mustang GT Fastback driven by the one and only Steve McQueen in the movie Bullet. Side note, I have wanted that car for at least a solid decade, so if anybody can lead me in that direction, I'm all ears. Rolling Stone magazine was founded in 1967. The city was, in a word, crazy, and the San Francisco Chronicle's Herb Kane tried to cover it all, becoming known as the go-to must-read columnist for the city, covering everything and anything. What no one saw coming was the emergence of a notorious serial killer at the end of the decade, lurking in the shadows and ready to paralyze the city in fear. On Friday, December 20th, 1968, 17-year-old David Faraday and 16-year-old Betty Lou Jensen were out on their first date. David was a Boy Scout. He did well in school. There was even a report of him having, quote, once confronted a marijuana dealer and threatened to report the man to police, end quote. Betty Lou Jensen was outgoing and popular at school. She loved art and she was quite talented. David and Betty Lou had met about 2 weeks earlier at a youth function and were finally able to coordinate a time to go out. And before their first date, David and another boy who also liked Betty Lou actually argued about David dating her. But David was so attracted to Betty Lou that he didn't let this argument stop him. And Betty was so excited. She even brought David home to meet her parents before they went out that evening. After spending some time at home, the couple stopped by a friend's house before David drove them to Betty's high school, Hogan High, where they attended a holiday concert. Knowing that they both had a curfew of 11 p.m. and that they had a bit of time after the concert before their parents expected them home, David and Betty Lou decided to park in a secluded gravel parking area on Lake Herman Road, known as a Lover's Lane, and was located just outside of Vallejo, California. When 11 p.m. came and went, and neither Betty Lou nor David had arrived back home, their parents probably at first assumed that they had just lost track of time, but eventually, the phone rang. At around 11:10 p.m., Stella Medeiros was driving on Lake Herman Road, heading to pick up her son in Benicia when she saw what looked like a body caught in her headlights. She slowed down, noticing a Rambler station wagon parked to the side. When she realized that there were actually two bodies on the ground, obviously something horrific had happened, so she sped away to get help. She passed a police car on her way to Benicia and flashed her lights to signal to the officer, who then radioed in the call for backup. Another detective named Pierre Bidot was in his patrol car when he heard the call came across the radio about the attack, so he drove out to Lake Herman Road and found the car. David Faraday was laying on the ground next to the passenger door with a gunshot wound to his head just above his left ear. Betty Lou Jensen's body was found nearly 30 feet from the car, shot 5 times in the back, most likely when she was fleeing from their attacker. She had also been shot 2 times in the chest. An ambulance rushed David Faraday to Vallejo General Hospital. He was still breathing when Detective Bito found him, but unfortunately he would die before he reached the hospital. The crime scene was littered with bullet casings, later determined to belong to small-caliber Winchester Super X ammunition. With this murder, police in Benicia and Solano County, who had jurisdiction because Lake Herman Road fell under their realm of responsibility, first believed it was an isolated incident. They followed up leads, including questioning the teenage boy Ricky, who had argued with David about dating Betty Lou, but none of the leads led to anything concrete. Betty Lou Jensen's best friend Sharon Henslin Stutzman recalled, quote, "There were no serial killers back then. All the detectives thought it had to be because of drugs. They refused to hear anything else," end quote. This conclusion by police stemmed from the counterculture movements that had taken over the Bay Area for the last decade. Drugs were everywhere, but the problem was that David and Betty Lou were good students. David was a Boy Scout. Betty Lou was a Grand Royal Guide of the Pythian Sunshine Girls. They're not exactly obvious members of the hippie free love, peace, and drugs movement. So with this information, assuming it was drug related, doesn't really make sense. Further investigation uncovered witnesses who reported seeing several cars in the area around the time of the murder. There were even reports of men in a blue car chasing teenagers in the area, but lead investigators Solano Deputy Russell T. Butterbach and Detective Sergeant Les Lundblad were never able to pinpoint the identities of the other people around that area at the time of the shooting. The two men questioned David and Betty Lou's families and friends, hoping to uncover some detail that would explain why these two nice, well-liked teens were murdered. Not long after David's funeral, on December 23rd, Sergeant Lundblad began to question if the two teens were killed by a random passerby and not by someone who knew them. Were David and Betty Lou in the wrong place at the wrong time? Had they been gunned down by a maniac who was just beginning a murder spree? He wouldn't get his answer until July 1969. On July 5th, 1969, at 12:40 a.m., 26-year-old dispatcher Nancy Slover answered a 911 call. The voice on the other end was frighteningly calm and steady. "I want to report a double murder. If you will go 1 mile east on Columbus Parkway to the public park, you will find the kids in a brown car. They were shot with a 9mm Luger. I also killed those kids last year. Goodbye." The person on the other end of the phone hung up, Nancy trying to wrap her mind around what she had just been told, the monotonous, almost rehearsed delivery of the information all the while. She's trying to take in what he was saying and get additional information about who he was and what he was reporting. Just with this phone call alone, there's a lot of controversy. Did Nancy Slover remember the information correctly? Did she get the wording exactly right when she transcribed it after the call ended? Were the somewhat incorrect directions the result of the killer messing with Slover, or was he just not as familiar with the area, possibly indicating that he wasn't a resident of Vallejo? There has been a debate about whether or not Slover's transcription was verbatim, or rather what is considered a quote-unquote substance of the statement transcription. When asked about the call, Nancy recalled that, quote, "the Zodiac killer was speaking in a rehearsed, monotone fashion as if reading from a script," end quote. So these 46 words spoken in as little as, let's say, 15 to 20 seconds, most likely with crucial pauses and breaks in the speaking, as well as a confession to murdering four people, I'd say that would be a lot to take in, even for a seasoned 911 dispatcher. And for those who have analyzed this call, some believe that the Zodiac was directing police to Blue Rock Springs Park from around the area of 111 Armador Street. But again, the distance and the directions don't really make sense if you want to get into the weeds of the directions, since Columbus Parkway doesn't travel due east like the killer said you should drive. Depending on whether you're driving north or south, you're either driving northeast or southwest. But despite all of this, the call went out to officers in the area who eventually found 22-year-old Darlene Farron and 19-year-old Mike Majot riddled with gunshot wounds. They found Darlene dead from 5 gunshot wounds. Majot had sustained 4. The ballistics report indicated that it was a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, and like with the first attack on Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday, there was no obvious motive, no sexual assault, no robbery. Again, just kind of seemed to be wrong place, wrong time. Darlene had worked as a waitress and was married. Majot was not in a relationship and had a job as a laborer, so the fact that a married woman was out late with a single man led police to consider that the shooter could have been Darlene's husband, Dean. But Dean had a solid alibi because he was working a shift as a cook at Caesar's restaurant during the time that Darlene and Majot were shot. Darlene also had a previous husband named James Philip Crabtree, who they also considered a suspect, but he was eventually ruled out as well. As Michael Majot recovered in the hospital, police interviewed him several times, and he tried to give them as much detail as he could remember about the moments leading up to and during the attack. In his statement, Majot told police how he and Darlene had driven out to the park to talk when Majot stated a light brown or tan car, possibly a Ford Mustang or a Chevrolet Corvair, pulled into the lot near their car. A man got out and shone a flashlight into the vehicle, and at first, Majot told police that he and Darlene assumed the man was a police officer and were prepared to hand over their IDs. And then, without uttering a single word, the man began firing at Darlene and Michael. 5 shots rang out, and then he slowly turned, heading back to his car. Michael tried to move inside the car and yelped in pain, which caused the man to walk quickly back and fire 2 more shots at him and then 2 more at Darlene. The man never spoke, got back in his car, and drove away. This second round of shots gave Majot a clearer look at the man who shot them. He described the shooter as, quote, white, 5'8 to 5'9, in his late 20s to early 30s, stocky build, round face, and brown hair, end quote. Before police had discovered Darlene and Michael, before anyone knew what had happened, less than an hour before, that's when Vallejo Police Department received the call answered by Nancy Slover. Realizing that the man who reported the double murder was most likely the person responsible, police feared that it was a very distinct possibility that he would do it again. But what happened next threw everyone for a loop. On July 31st, 1969, more than 3 weeks after Darlene and Michael Mageau were shot, three letters arrived at the Vallejo Times-Herald, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the San Francisco Examiner. In the letters were details about the murders that hadn't been released to the public, but that wasn't the most bizarre part of each letter. In addition to the information proving the sender was the killer, each newspaper received part of a cipher claiming to reveal the killer's name if someone was able to solve the puzzle. The letter itself was signed, quote, with a circle with a plus sign over it, his symbol, end quote. Looking at this symbol, it resembles a couple of different things. Some see a gun sight, some see the countdown that's played at the beginning of old films, and of course, this first cipher was solved not long after it was put in the paper by Donald Hardin and his wife Betty, who lived in Salinas. The killer didn't leave his name, but this first letter and cipher said, quote, I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise, and all the I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife, end quote. This rambling letter was the first of many. This was all a game to him. And the mysterious letters like this would continue to arrive in the hands of different newspapers and police for the next 5 years. In August 1969, another letter was sent to the San Francisco Examiner, and this time, the killer gave himself a name. Quote, Dear Editor, this is the Zodiac speaking. In answer to your asking for more details about the good times I have had in Vallejo, I shall be very happy to supply even more materials. By the way, are the police having a good time with the code? End quote. This letter continues on for several pages, taunting police, taunting the media, the citizens of the Bay Area, again giving details that only the killer would know and what was described by Michael Mageau in his interview with police, in particular the use of a flashlight on the gun. What's interesting about these letters is the number of misspellings, and it's difficult to determine if they were done on purpose or by accident. With two separate attacks claimed by the same person, as well as these threatening letters, police issued warnings and set curfews. They warned people to stay home and be vigilant, but clearly the man behind these murders was thriving on the attention given to his crimes and possibly felt like he had to keep pushing the boundaries, pushing the way he committed his murders. And unfortunately, 22-year-old Cecilia Shepherd and 20-year-old Brian Hartnell would be his next targets. On September 27, 1969, Shepherd and Hartnell were enjoying a quiet, leisurely Saturday together. They had driven up to Lake Berryessa, and Hartnell parked his white Carmangia on Knoxville Road around 5:30 p.m. that day after they had passed some friends, Marilyn Denise and her companion John, who Brian knew. They said hi to each other and continued along their way. The couple walked about a quarter of a mile down to a remote area on the shoreline. They laid out a blanket and were enjoying the beautiful sunny weather as the sun began to go down, with timeline analysis putting them at the shore around 6 p.m. that evening. Brian recalled that at some point, Cecilia noticed a man walking towards them wearing some sort of costume. He was holding a gun, and based on Brian's recollection, he was a physically imposing man, possibly taller than 6 feet, with a large build. Brian and Cecilia got to their knees as the man rushed over to them, pointing the gun at them and telling them not to move. Brian later told police that, quote, The man claimed he was a prison escapee from either Montana or Colorado and needed money and a car to flee to Mexico, end quote. Brian tossed his wallet and keys towards the man, hoping that this was just a robbery and that he would leave them alone after he got what he needed. Unfortunately, this wouldn't be all. The man then used a clothesline and tied them up. But again, Brian and Cecilia probably believed that he would leave and not hurt them, but the man then pulled out a large knife measuring somewhere between 10 and 12 inches with a wooden handle and began repeatedly stabbing Cecilia and Brian. The couple was discovered after a nearby fisherman heard them screaming and rushed over to find a park ranger. But because of how isolated the location was, it took nearly an hour for the ambulance to arrive, and both Brian and Cecilia were in bad shape. Cecilia had been stabbed 10 times on her front and back, while Brian had been stabbed 6 times in the back. Unfortunately, Cecilia succumbed to her injuries 2 days later on September 29th, while Brian would go on to survive and was able to give police information on what happened in the days following the attack. Brian Hartnell would also give several interviews over the next few years about the attack, but eventually decided that it was enough. It was too painful, and he didn't want to talk about it anymore. He would go on to become an attorney in Southern California. The timeline of this attack is particularly interesting and can be a bit confusing, but I'm going to try to make it as clear and concise as I can. After news broke of this attack, a couple of witnesses came forward and told police what they had seen in the area shortly around the time before and after the stabbing. Dr. Clifton Rayfield and his son were driving out on Knoxville Road and pulled over to park their car sometime after 6:30 p.m. that day. They had noticed a white Karmann Ghia parked, but no other vehicles, and as they passed the Karmann Ghia, they continued almost a mile north on the road before they stopped and pulled over. But prior to parking, they recalled how they saw a man, quote, wearing a long-sleeved dark shirt with red coloring, end quote, saying that the sighting was also around 6:30 p.m. A phone call was placed from a payphone in downtown Napa at 7:40 p.m. to the Napa Police Department and was answered by dispatcher Dave Slate. Detectives were able to determine that if the attack happened at approximately 6:30 p.m., as it was written on the Karmann Ghia's door, and the 0.8-mile distance from that car to where Dr. Rayfield was parked took the Zodiac approximately 20 to 25 minutes to walk, it's likely that Dr. Rayfield and his son saw Zodiac around the time of the attack. And if this man they saw was Zodiac, there are a few possible conclusions we can make. One is that the red coloring on his shirt was probably blood. Two is that he was spotted by Dr. Rayfield, most likely walking to his car that was parked out of sight. As I said, Dr. Rayfield couldn't remember seeing any other cars besides Brian Hartnell's Karmann Ghia. And three is that the timeline between this sighting and the 7:40 p.m. call to police checks out, as the drive from Lake Berryessa to that phone booth where the call would be traced to would have taken about 45 minutes, meaning that if this man that they saw was the Zodiac, he then left the area around 6:55 p.m. and drove 45 minutes to place the call at the exact time that the killer called police. The only problem with all of this assumption and the sighting reported by Dr. Rayfield is the accuracy of the times of Rayfield and his son parking their car and seeing the man that could have been the alleged Zodiac, and how that lines up with the facts that police know about the stabbing. Now, this was the late 1960s. Obviously, there were no cell phones, so our knowledge of time, at least for me, I know I check my phone a lot to check the time. I don't necessarily always look at my watch. So that was not a thing back then. Perhaps they were wearing a wristwatch. Perhaps there was a clock inside the vehicle. But I'd pose this question. How often do we check the time when we're just driving and we randomly see a person? I can't say that I do, so my best guess is that a lot of these times that were reported by Dr. Rayfield were estimated at best, and can't be considered 100% accurate. Additionally, when police arrived at the scene, they found the Carmangia. They noticed that there were tire tracks from a different vehicle behind the Carmangia, indicating that possibly the Zodiac parked there while he wrote the time of the stabbing as well as the dates of his two previous attacks on the Carmangia's car door. So was the sighting by Dr. Rayfield accurate? Did he see Zodiac as he was making his getaway after the attack, or did they see him before the attack? Now, there was only Dr. Rayfield and the Carmangia, so it's possible that if they did spot Zodiac, he was likely climbing back up to where his car was parked and hidden, and probably around 6:50 p.m. and not closer to 6:30. That 6:30 time could have been an estimate by Dr. Rayfield. Like, again, how often do you check the time when you just randomly see someone? There's also the thought that Zodiac could have either written the message on the car door first and then walked the almost mile distance to his car and left, but this wouldn't explain the different tire tracks. Or he could have walked up to his car and drove it back down to where Hartnell's car was parked, written the message on the car door, and then continued south towards Napa. Unfortunately, there's no way to be sure of what actually happened and when. The timeline is iffy. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of assumptions based on that timeline, and no real degree of accuracy in anything from eyewitnesses specific to the times of the attacks or the sighting, other than what Brian Hartnell was able to recall about the man who attacked him in Cecilia, as well as the actual evidence found at the crime scene and on the car, the message on the car, and then at the crime scene, which included footprints that matched a size 10.5 Wingwalker shoe and were found to be available at Army surplus stores as well as on military installations. Additionally, based on Hartnell's description and the shoe print, police were able to estimate that the attacker weighed at least 210 pounds. Okay, friends, I'm going to take a very short break, so hang tight, digest all of that, and I'll be right back. And welcome back, my friends. The Lake Berryessa attack did shine a light on a previous murder in Riverside, California, and what is now considered the Zodiac Killer's first official known victim, Sherry Jo Bates, who was murdered on October 30th, 1966. The similarities between her murder and evidence found at the attack at Lake Berryessa gave police the information needed to connect her murder to the Zodiac. She had graduated from Ramona High School and was in her first year of college. On the night of October 30th, Sherry Jo decided to head to her library at the college and work on some assignments. She was last seen leaving the library shortly before 9:30 p.m. heading towards her Volkswagen Beetle. Sherry Jo's body would be discovered in an alley the following morning, just 100 yards from where her car was parked. She had been beaten and stabbed with what was later believed to be a knife with a small blade, and her throat was cut as well. Police also discovered that her car wouldn't have started if she had gotten in it to drive away, and it's likely that the person who killed her disabled the engine to prevent her from leaving. At the scene, police found a heel print that looked like a military-style shoe, roughly between the sizes of men's 8 and 10. There was also, quote, a men's Timex watch with a band suggesting a 7-inch wrist. Investigators established the watch was ripped from the attacker's wrist during the struggle. Although the watch stopped at 12:24, it's unknown exactly when the crime occurred. Bates died very quickly, end quote. And with this, police estimated the attack occurred sometime between 9:23 p.m. on October 30th and 12:23 a.m. on October 31st. Investigators were also able to determine that the watch was only able to be purchased at a military post, and the shoes appeared military as well, leading some to conclude that the perpetrator likely had some connection to the military. The murder of Sherry Jo Bates stood alone as a single act of violence and not part of a spree for nearly 3 years until Riverside police took another look at her murder in light of the Zodiac killings. Noticing several similarities between Bates' murder and the attack on Cecilia Shepherd and Brian Hartnell at Lake Berryessa, such as the similar style letters taunting police and family members, as well as the fact that they were both stabbing attacks, those handling Sherry Joe's case and detectives working the Zodiac investigation met to discuss the possibility of Zodiac being named responsible for Sherry Joe Bates' death. By November 1970, media outlets had picked up on this assumption, with the San Francisco Chronicle as well as the LA Times covering the possibility in separate articles. Previously, on November 29, 1966, and again on April 30, 1967, police in Riverside received anonymous letters claiming responsibility for Sherry Joe's death, as well as the letters contained key details that only the killer would know, just like the letters sent by the Zodiac Killer. The November 1966 letter was typewritten and claimed to give police the killer's next intended victim, as well as how he was able to approach Sherry Joe the night she was killed. While the other letters sent in April 1967, there were three of them. One was sent to Sherry Joe's father, Joseph Bates. One was sent to the Riverside Press Enterprise newspaper, and one was sent to the Riverside Police Department. They were all handwritten and much less wordy, stating only things like, quote, "Bates had to die, there will be more," end quote. Police also discovered, quote, "a desk with a morbid poem scratched into the surface," end quote. It had been found in the college's library in December 1966 and was determined to match other writings belonging to Zodiac. The poem was titled, quote, "Sick of Living, Unwilling to Die," end quote, and spoke of graphic things like blood spurting and, quote, "life draining into an uncertain death," end quote. With all of this, it was concluded that the Zodiac killings had actually begun prior to the murders of Betty Lou Jensen and David Faraday. His first victim was now considered Sherry Joe Bates. Now, these are the five confirmed victims of Zodiac. Plus, there was another man, Paul Stein, whose case I'll go over in just a little bit. During his letters, however, Zodiac did claim to have killed as many as 37 people to police and the news medias, but there is one man who is also suspected of being a victim outside of those six people, and that is the 27-year-old victim Ray Davis, who was shot on April 10th, 1962. Davis worked as a taxi driver for the Checkered Cab Company, and at the time of his death, he was living at 525 South Tremont Street with his brother. He had recently separated from his wife. According to Davis's fare book, he picked up a passenger at 11:10 p.m. from a cab stand thought to be on Mission Avenue. So this is downtown in Oceanside, which is much further south than any of the other Zodiac killings. Davis had notified his dispatch that he was taking this passenger to South Oceanside, but after that transmission, no one ever heard from Ray Davis again the rest of the night. His body would be found dumped in an alley in St. Malo, which was an upscale gated community in Oceanside, and his cab was found at 400 South Pacific Street. So the killer had shot Davis twice, hitting him in the back and in the head, then dumped his body out of the car, drove his cab to this other location, and escaped. There was no obvious motive for the shooting. Davis hadn't been robbed, so for years, like Sherry Joe Bates' murder, Davis's was considered a standalone incident. However, this was in 1962, and it may have been Zodiac's first real kill based on some very telling similarities between his death and what police knew and attributed to the Zodiac murders. The man who is assumed to have shot Davis contacted police before the murder and then called again after, threatening to attack a bus driver, much like the letters Zodiac sent in 1969 and beyond. He clearly wanted to confuse police, and that was definitely similar to what the killer told police before Ray Davis was killed. He told them, quote, "he would soon be committing a baffling crime," end quote. There is also the similar threat against a bus or a bus driver in both Davis's case as well as in Zodiac's October 13, 1969 letter, where he claimed responsibility for the shooting death of another cab driver, Paul Stein, and he also threatened to, quote, wipe out a school bus some morning, just shoot out the front tire, and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out, end quote. Paul Stein was murdered while completing a fare in his cab. The October 13th letter would also include a piece of Paul Stein's bloody shirt. After picking up his passenger at Mason and Geary Streets based on his fare book, Stein had pulled over his cab at the corner of Washington Street and Cherry Street in Presidio Heights shortly before 10 p.m. According to his fare book, the intended destination was Washington and Maple, which was one block away. 29-year-old Stein was shot in the back of the head by his assailant, who used a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, the same type that was used to shoot Michael Mageau and kill Darlene Farren. However, unlike any of the other Zodiac attacks, this one was the first with actual witnesses. Three people watched as the alleged Zodiac and Stein struggled in the cab, and others, including two patrolmen, saw a man later suspected to be Zodiac walking calmly down the street shortly after the call went out about the shooting. However, these officers, Donald Folk and Eric Zelms, didn't come forward until nearly a month later after they saw a composite sketch of the Zodiac. The witnesses who saw the murder, as well as these police officers, all reported very similar descriptions of the man. Quote, he was white, 35 to 45 years old, 5'10", between 180 and 200 pounds, barrel-chested, with light-colored, crew-cut hair, and wearing glasses, end quote. And if you remember, that's very similar to Michael Mageau's description of the man who shot him and Darlene Farren. However, if the man walking down the street that the police officers saw was Zodiac, he literally only escaped by chance, because the initial description of the suspect in the shooting was released at first as a black adult male, so that's who police were looking for. The difference between this murder and all of the other murders attributed to Zodiac is that Stein was robbed in the process. His wallet and his keys were taken, as well as a portion of his shirt. The killer also left behind bloody size 7 gloves. And despite Zodiac claiming responsibility for Stein's murder, that part of the case was closed in early 2004, while the overall Zodiac case still remains open in Vallejo, Napa, and Solano counties for the other murders. After the murder of Paul Stein, there are no known victims of Zodiac. Instead, he continued to send letters claiming he had killed people, threatening, taunting, and begging police and newspapers to print his letters and come find him. There were two letters sent back-to-back on November 8th and 9th. First was a card with a picture of a dripping pen. It's kind of a jokey card, as the Zodiac thought they, quote, would need a good laugh before you hear the bad news, end quote, and then asking for a cipher to be printed because he gets, quote, awfully lonely when I am ignored. So lonely, I could do my thing, end quote. The cipher in this letter would later be referred to as Cipher 340. The letter the following day, beginning as most of his letters would with the phrase, "This is the Zodiac speaking," would claim that he had constructed a bomb and buried it, complete with a schematic of the bomb, and that he would no longer announce when he was going to kill anyone, which is both terrifying, but it also lets him off the hook a bit. If he doesn't provide details of who or when or how he's going to kill someone, he can take credit for deaths of people when he likely didn't do it. One of the most well-known letters is the December 20th, 1969 letter sent to actor and lawyer Melvin Belli, asking Belli to help him before he loses control. Previously, on October 22nd, 1969, quote, the Oakland Police Department received a phone call from a man claiming to be the Zodiac. The caller said he wanted famous Boston attorney F. Lee Bailey to appear on a local television talk show, but told the operator that he would settle for San Francisco lawyer Melvin Belli in the event Bailey was unable to appear, end quote. And if the name F. Lee Bailey sounds vaguely or not so vaguely familiar, It's because he would go on to be famously involved in the defense team of one Orenthal James Simpson in 1994. He also represented killers in other famous cases like the alleged Boston Strangler Albert DeSalvo, and he even represented Patty Hearst, among others. And because Bailey was based on the East Coast at the time, it actually made more sense to have Melvin Belli available for the Zodiac call, and Belli agreed. So on October 22nd, Belli and talk show host Jim Dunbar went live on the KGO TV station to answer the Zodiac's call, but the caller was an imposter who identified himself as Sam and wasn't the real Zodiac. After the December 20th letter, the Zodiac would go silent for 4 months, sending a letter along with a cipher that claimed to be his name on April 20th, 1970. In this letter, he claims to have killed 10 people so far, and that the number, quote, would have been a lot more, except that my bus bomb was a dud, end quote. Again, very convenient that this bomb he claimed to have built never went off. So, did he really do it? Probably not. Over the next year, Zodiac would send 5 more letters on April 28th, June 26th, July 24th, July 26th, and October 27th. In each of these letters, he continues his dialogue with the reader, wanting people to wear Zodiac buttons and threatening to harm people if they don't, or that certain information isn't released to the public, that if the Chronicle doesn't tell everyone about the bomb, but it's almost like he forgot that in a previous letter he said the bomb was a dud, or maybe he's implying that he's built another bomb. So, okay. He also claims to have killed other people or tortured others. For example, in his June 26th letter, he wrote, quote, I shot a man sitting in a parked car with a .38, end quote. And this murder was unconfirmed and is not considered attributable to the Zodiac. And that another bomb had been set to go off along with a map, but this bomb also never went off. In his July 24th letter, he spoke about a woman later revealed to be Kathleen Johns and her baby who were supposedly taken for a terrifying joyride with Zodiac for 90 minutes on March 22nd, 1970. Zodiac would only send 2 letters in 1971, which arrived on March 13th at the LA Times and March 22nd at the San Francisco Chronicle. He chose to send a letter to the Times because, quote, they don't bury me on the back pages like some of the others, end quote, and also claimed to have killed 17 people at this point. The letter to the Chronicle was specifically addressed to Paul Avery, who was one of the top crime journalists in the Bay Area and heavily covered the Zodiac killings. This letter would actually be the second one sent to Avery. He also received a Halloween card on October 27th, 1970, that said, Peekaboo, you're doomed, from your secret pal. Except the secret pal wasn't so secret, because by this point, everyone recognized the handwriting as being Zodiac's. After the March 22nd letter, no one would hear from Zodiac for almost 3 years, when the Chronicle finally received another letter on January 29th, 1974. The letter was fairly short, considering how much time had passed. In it, Zodiac wrote, quote, I saw and think The Exorcist was the best satirical comedy that I have ever seen. Signed, yours truly. He plunged himself into the billowy wave, and an echo arose from the suicide's grave. Titwillow, titwillow, titwillow. P.S. If I do not see this note in your paper, I will do something nasty, which you know I'm capable of doing, end quote. He then claims in this letter that he killed 37 people, and so he is almost keeping a tally between him and San Francisco police. So his number is 37, SFPD is 0. It's also interesting that he didn't sign this letter with the Zodiac symbol like most of his other letters. He also sent additional letters on February 14th, May 8th, and July 8th, but in none of these letters does he outright identify himself as Zodiac, use the Zodiac symbol, or begin the letter with his signature, "This is the Zodiac speaking." Instead, he either doesn't sign them or closes with a citizen or a new nickname, the Red Phantom. It's suspected that these are zodiac letters, but I wonder if they could be copycats, considering the tone of the letters and the signatures changed so much. The last letter attributed to Zodiac was received on May 2nd, 1978 by KHJ-TV in Los Angeles, California. This one begins with, "This is the Zodiac speaking," and goes on to say that he plans to start killing again, but names all five of his intended victims. Honestly, to me, this one feels more like Zodiac than any of the 1974 letters, and I will link the website that has all of the letters available on it if you're interested in going back and reading them. But because we literally have no idea who this person is, it's hard to determine whether or not all of the letters, or just some of them, are from Zodiac. Okay, my friends, that was part one of the Zodiac murders. I decided to break this case up because there is just so much information to get through, and I didn't want to risk basically fire hosing all of you and not being as thorough and clear and linear as possible in the information and the details that I'm telling you. Next week, I'm going to cover each of the known Zodiac suspects as well as the latest developments in the case, which includes the most recent development in the 340 cipher, which was solved in December 2020, as well as the status of the overall Zodiac investigation. What is most frustrating about this case, and I'm sure you'll all agree, is just how many unknowns there are, as well as the fact that there are families out there whose loved ones were killed and they don't know for sure who did it, so there's never been any real closure for them, as well as the people like Michael Mageau and Brian Hartnell who survived the attacks by Zodiac. As always, if you have a particular case that you're interested in, please let me know. I'm looking to fill my schedule through the summer, so if you have something you're interested in, message me or shoot me an email. As always, a huge thank you to anyone who is an active Patreon supporter or a supporter of my merch store or my coffee account. It means so much to me that you've chosen to help my show out that way. Please stick around after the show for the trailer from Jules of Riddle Me That True Crime and Robin from The Trail Went Cold, who will be doing an extended series which began on March 1st, so just a few days ago. They are covering the tragic murder of Jacob Jeremiah Londin in April 1987. Thank you all so much for listening, and please join me next week when I take you through part two of the Zodiac murders. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hi, I'm Jules from Riddle Me That True Crime.
I'm Robin Warder from The Trail Went Cold, and Jules and I want to tell you a little bit about a case that means a great deal to us, the death of 9-month-old baby Jacob Landin on April the 10th, 1987, in Socorro, New Mexico.
The day prior to his death, on April 9th, baby Jacob was being watched by his mother Brenda's new boyfriend John, not his real name, in his mobile home on 1453 Fatima Drive. While John was babysitting Jacob, Jacob would incur what would be his second head injury in a period of weeks. The prior head injury was a subdural hematoma, or brain bleed, and it was serious enough that it needed to be lanced to take pressure off baby Jacob's brain while being monitored by doctors over the course of several days.
The circumstances surrounding how Jacob was injured and subsequently died are murky at best, with the suspect giving multiple versions of the events of the day, ranging from Jacob choking and accidentally hitting his head while trying to dislodge a cookie, to Jacob falling and John returning to see the injured infant.
The suspect also reportedly confessed to officers that he was indeed responsible, but there is no paper or audio record of this confession in the police file. The reasons given by the DA for not pursuing the case are confusing as well, with one of the reasons being that they were worried that John would file charges against the state.
It was the opinion of the doctors that baby Jacob was struck in the head, and this was no accident. In the years to follow, John goes on to sexually abuse young Eric, as well as physically abusing his mother Brenda, and emotionally abusing and isolating them both, making the world very small.
During the autopsy, layers of abuse seem to be present. A healing rib fracture from around the time of the first head injury is also discovered. It's impossible to say exactly when the injury took place, but what is clear is that someone was abusing young Jacob, and that person was most likely John.
Eric Landine, Jacob's brother, has been fighting to get justice for him. However, he faces some obstacles, such as the statute of limitations of 6 years on second-degree murder that State Representative Bill Rehm has petitioned to have overturned.
Join Robin and I, as well as criminologist Dr. Ashley Wellman, an investigative expert, a legal expert, a forensic psychiatrist, as well as Jacob's brother Eric, as we explore all angles of this case and try to bring awareness, understanding, and hopefully, ultimately, justice for Jacob.
The series starts on March 1st. Tune in on your favorite podcast app.